Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia, and dedicated to the proposition articulated by Walter Lippmann during World War II that a strong and balanced foreign policy is the shield of our democratic republic. I'm Eric Edelman. I'm a counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, a contributor to the Bulwark, and a non-resident fellow at the Miller Center at the University of Virginia. My normal partner, Elliot Cohn, is still traveling, but he will be back in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, I have as a very special guest, Ganul Tol, who's the founding director of the Middle East Institute's Turkey program. She was educated at Middle East Technical University in Ankara, a place where one of my distinguished predecessors as ambassador of the United States to the Republic of Turkey had his armored Cadillac limousine overturned and burned. Luckily, when I was ambassador and spoke there, it was much less eventful. But she's also got a PhD from Florida International University, where I've actually spoken on several occasions. It's a really lovely place. And she also has taught at George Washington University and the National Defense University, and is the author, importantly, of Erdogan's War, A Strongman's Struggle at Home and in Syria, which has just been published by Oxford University Press. Ganul, welcome.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Your book, I think, is one of the very best I've read in a while on Turkey. I would put it in the company of Soner Çaptay's The New Sultan about Tayyip Erdogan. But your book really, I think, more than any I've read, captures the way in which Erdogan has both used foreign policy to further his domestic aims and the degree to which his foreign policy in many ways is subordinated to his domestic political aims during his 20-year rule. And we're now, you know, well into a period where he has ruled Turkey longer than Kemal Pasha Atatürk did. And so the imprint that he has on modern Turkey is enormous. Ganul, just start off by telling us what prompted you to write this book.
Well, two assumptions, Eric, that I kept hearing, especially in this town. And one was that everything that is wrong with Erdogan's new Turkey has something to do with his Islamist background. I remember, and that's in the opening chapter of the book, talking to a Western diplomat who told me, once an Islamist, always an Islamist. So the assumption there was the main driver behind the country's authoritarian turn was Erdogan's Islamist ideology. And the second argument that I hear very often in Washington, but also in Europe, is that Turkish foreign policy, Turkish domestic politics is not relevant for the Western world. What happens inside Turkey should not concern the Western world as long as Turkey behaves on the foreign policy front. So I wanted to challenge those two assumptions. So I make the case in the book that Islamism is only one of the factors that led to Turkey's authoritarian transformation. And I define Erdogan as first and foremost a populist. And now I know there's a lot of confusion around that concept, but I would say the consensus is that populism is not an ideology. It's a political style. But it doesn't really offer any solutions to economic, social, and political problems. So populists, they usually match their populist style with different ideologies. And Erdogan did exactly that. When he came to power in 2002, he said that he was not an Islamist anymore and that he defined himself and his new party as a conservative democratic party. And to substantiate that, he used foreign policy. He used Turkey's EU membership and also a very cautious approach vis-a-vis the Middle East to tell the voters that he was a new man, that he was not an Islamist, that he was a reformer in many ways. And that was an appealing statement, I think, that appealed to a lot of people who would otherwise be very skeptical about an Islamist-rooted politician. So Erdogan, in the first few terms until 2011, he used that concept and he used that identity that he picked for himself, that conservative democratic identity. And I think it was a brilliant idea because his number one goal when he came to power was to sideline the secularist establishment, but particularly the country's military. And he knew that he could not clash with the military directly. And instead, he pushed for a very pro-EU, pro-Western agenda, because getting Turkey into the EU would ensure that Turkish military was not going to play an outsized role in Turkish politics, because that's what EU membership called for. So that was a brilliant idea, idea. And with regards to Turkey's regional policy, the military always had red lines vis-a-vis the region. And the number one red line was preventing Kurdish separatism. And number two was preventing spread of political Islam. So Erdogan, after he came to power, he made sure he did not cross those red lines in the Middle East. And instead, he built his Middle East policy on trade and investment. He didn't really refer to common Islamic heritage, Ottoman heritage. He stayed away from those concepts, not to provoke the military. So those strategies, I think, paved the way, and he managed to sideline the secularist military and centralize power in his own hands. And by 2011, he had already controlled the country's main institutions, including courts, media, Turkish business. So he had centralized power. So he was done with that conservative democratic brand. And he needed a new identity for himself and for his party. And his new goal was to switch the country's parliamentary system to a presidential system without any checks and balances. And he understood that he could not really secure the backing of his previous allies, like liberals, conservatives, social democrats, what was basically to establish an autocratic rule. So he turned his attention to a different constituency, which was the country's Kurdish and Turkish conservatives. So from 2011 onwards, he embraced an Islamist ideology, and he defined himself as the protector of Muslims and Islamists. And I think the Arab uprisings came at a perfect moment for him, because the Arab uprisings allowed him to basically extend that Islamist platform beyond Turkey's borders. So he threw his support behind the Islamists of the region trying to topple regional autocrats, and he framed that support as his way of protecting Muslim demands across the world. So it was a perfect fit for his domestic narrative that he was the protector of Muslims. But then that strategy, when it failed to work, when it failed to secure him what he wanted, then he switched tactics and he became a nationalist. So the book tells the story of how he managed to leap from one ideology to the other. So ideologies that he embraced changed, but one thing remained, which is he's always his first and foremost a populist. So that's the main theme of the book. And when I talk about how he transformed the country from an aspiring democracy to a competitive authoritarian regime, I focus on something that's, I think, largely been ignored, both in the political science literature and in policy circles, and that is the role of foreign policy. So foreign policy is not just about what Erdogan does on the foreign policy in international affairs, but it's closely tied to his domestic calculations to centralize power.
You and I were joking before we came on in the green room about the fact that I was having PTSD as I read this book. And it's true, because so much of your description of this rings true with my own personal experience, which in some ways actually even antedates my arrival in Ankara as ambassador. So just to provide some validation for you, in early 2003, as you recall, he won the by-election in Sirte to get a seat in parliament after having been banned from politics for a number of years. And this occurred just after the failure of the Turkish Grand National Assembly's vote on allowing the 4th Infantry Division into Turkey for the Iraq War. And so I bumped into Condoleezza Rice. We were both getting coffee at like 6:30 in the morning after the election in the White House mess. And I said, we really should get the president to call, you know, Erdogan, maybe we could like reverse this thing. And she said, no, I don't think the president's going to do that, but you should get the vice president to do it. So Vice President Cheney did in fact call Erdogan and congratulated him on winning his parliamentary seat. And I was listening in on the call and taking notes. And one of the things that transpired in the call was the vice president said, are you going to have another vote on the Tescade to let the troops in? And I'll never forget Erdogan's answer. He basically said, I don't know yet. He said, because I'm a populist type politician and I have to go from strength to strength because of the opposition forces I face. I can't afford to ever lose anything. So I'm going to look at it and decide later. And of course they didn't in fact have a second vote at that time. But I mean, it stuck with me because that was his own description of himself as a populist type politician. To use the political science term, Gönül, which you use in your book, Erdogan was trying to desecuritize Turkey's foreign policy in order to accomplish what you suggest he was setting out to do, which was clip the wings of the military. And in that regard, the EU accession program, as you point out, was one very useful tool because the EU made it quite clear that the military needed to retreat from its oversight political role in Turkey for it to be considered for membership. And then he was able to use the program articulated by Ahmet Davutoğlu, who was one of his advisors and later became his foreign minister and his prime minister, that Turkey should have zero problems with its neighbors. I mean, and you know, Davutoğlu's vision was, as you know, very grandiose. It looked at Turkey as a potential, as he would describe it, sometimes Muslim superpower. Of course, Davutoğlu, having, you know, played out his role for Erdogan, was then ultimately cast aside and now is leading one of the opposition parties in the table of six, which I think is polling at around 1%. His party, that is, not the table of six. But anyway, I go through all of that because you make a very interesting point, which is a lot of us were, you know, spending a lot of time, you know, parsing Davutoğlu's writings to try and decipher Erdogan's policy. But you make the point that while Davutoğlu was an ideologue, Erdogan was not. Erdogan really was much more flexible. He was happy to use this as a way of, as you put it, desecuritizing the environment so that there weren't, you know, a lot of enemies on Turkey's periphery that would justify the military playing a large role. The irony, of course, is that once this policy was implemented, it ended up, you know, with nothing but enemies on Turkey's periphery after a while. How do you explain that irony?
Well, to go back to what you said, Eric, about the March Parliament's decision not to allow the U.S. troops to use Turkish territory to go into Iraq, I'm sure you know, Erdogan actually wanted the parliament to pass that motion. And he was one of the very few and maybe the only person in his party who pushed for that. So that tells you how big of a pragmatist Erdogan has always been. Because I think at the time he really wanted to secure U.S. support. But others in his party, like Abdullah Gül, for instance, who later became the president, and Ahmet Davutoğlu, I think they're more a lot more ideological, and they were opposed to this based on ideological grounds. And you're right, Ahmet Davutoğlu, I think he is the ideologue here, and Erdogan is not. And Erdogan was happy to use his ideas when the time was right for him. Erdogan, Davutoğlu wrote about these things in the 1990s in his column for Yeni Şafak newspaper. And at the time, he said, you know, Turkey should work with regional autocrats. But there will come a time when real Muslims will rise against their oppressors. And when that time comes, we have to back those forces. So from Davutoğlu's point of view, 2010, late 2010 and 2011 was that time. When the Arab uprising started, he really thought that it was a historic moment for Turkey to become the leader of the region again. And people close to him and himself too, they often referred to the Arab uprisings as the Arabs' way of their efforts to topple their own CHP. Because in their narrative, the AKP had come to power and they toppled what they called the godless elitist regime that was not in tune with society. And the AKP, in many ways, carried out a revolution. That's how they saw it, and democratized the country. So when the Arab uprisings began, Davutoğlu thought that finally I was right. That the people, the real Muslims, are now rebelling against their oppressors and we have to back them. So that's how he saw it. But from Erdogan's point of view, being a very pragmatic leader, he saw that as a golden opportunity for him to once again substantiate the claims he was making on the campaign trail. And that was, I am the protector of the Ummah, the Muslim nation. So I didn't just save Turkey's Muslims from the CHP, but I'm going to do that for others in the world too. So that's his way of telling the voters that he was the protector of Muslims across the world. But I think obviously we now know, and later Ahmet Davutoğlu himself admitted that it was short-sighted. And for this book, I talked to Abdullah Gül, I interviewed him. And at the time I asked him what he thought of Turkey's support, which began very early in the uprisings, for Muslim Brotherhood. And right. He said also that it was short-sighted. And particularly the most problematic part was in Syria, because in Syria, in Turkey, there's a large group of Muslim Brotherhood members who have been living in Turkey since the 1980s, after the Hama massacre, which killed thousands of Muslim Brotherhood members at the time who had rebelled against the Assad regime. So many of them fled the country and they started living in Turkey. Many of them went to Turkish universities. They hold Turkish passports. So after the uprising in Syria started, they had the ear of Erdogan and Ahmet Davutoğlu, and they saw what was happening on the ground through the lens of Muslim Brotherhood in Turkey, which obviously did not reflect the reality on the ground, because from Syrian Muslim Brotherhood members living in Turkey, the way they conveyed the developments on the ground basically told that we are very influential on the ground, which was not the case. And obviously there was something else that was really wrong with the way Erdogan and Davutoğlu saw developments in Syria. And that was, they didn't understand and appreciate how much resentment there was towards Muslim Brotherhood among Syrian society. And another problematic assumption about Syria by Ahmet Davutoğlu was that he always assumed that Bashar al-Assad only had 10-15% support of society from Alevi community. He didn't understand that a large group of Sunni Muslims, including middle class, business class, they supported the regime. They benefited from the regime. So for me, for a country like Turkey, who has been there on the ground because of the PKK presence there, how come they did not understand this neighboring country? And the reason, I think the answer to that question was because Davutoğlu's ideology really clouded his judgment.
Mm-hmm.
And Erdogan, he's always been clueless about the world. But I think Davutoğlu led him to believe that Assad was going to leave in a matter of a few weeks even.
Right.
And Erdogan believed him. So obviously that was a miscalculation.
Yeah, I mean, and of course, it wasn't just in Syria, although I want to come back to Syria in a moment, but also backing for the Muslim Brotherhood Morsi regime in Egypt, which ended up backfiring, the support for the Muslim Brotherhood in Syria, which immediately aroused the antagonism of the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia and the UAE, which were concerned about the Brotherhood in their own sphere. It got Turkey very involved in Libya as well. I think it's very important to point out that this kind of regional activism was really the antithesis of what Turkey had been used to in the sort of Kemalist dispensation, which was, you know, peace in the world, peace at home. You know, Turkey should not play this outsized role in the region, in part because Ataturk and the Kemalists were trying to get away from the Ottoman legacy and concentrate on Turkey as a, you know, Western-oriented nation state. But as you point out, this is really kind of, first of all, it was not a very popular policy to begin with in Turkey. A lot of reticence about getting involved in Syria and in the civil war. As you point out, a lot of, how can I put it, naivete about what was going on. I mean, I recall Davutoğlu even privately telling people some of the Islamist groups were just misled Muslim youth. They weren't really terrorists. So, I mean, a real misreading, as you say, of the facts on the ground. But it's ultimately led to a presence of 4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey, which has created an enormous problem domestically for Erdogan politically, along with his economic mismanagement as well. I want to kind of get to what the political consequences of all this might be, but just tell our listeners a little bit about how much this intervention in Syria both has impacted Turkey as a society and a polity, but also the role it's played in Erdogan's increasing authoritarian turn and taking the country in a very authoritarian direction.
Well, I think Syria played, and it played a very key role in Erdogan's attempts to consolidate his power, and that was one of the reasons why I picked Syria to tell Erdogan's story of transforming Turkey into an authoritarian regime. Syria played a critical role due to several things, and the first one is, again, it came in very handy for Erdogan to burnish the image he picked for himself. From 2011, as I said, he defined himself as an Islamist, as someone who would protect interests and democratic aspirations of other Muslims in the region and in the world. So initially, I think that narrative really struck a nerve. It became very popular, particularly among Erdogan's supporters, because his goal at home was to secure the support of conservatives, both conservative Turks and Kurds, to switch to an all-powerful presidency. That was his goal. And he used Arab uprisings to reach that goal, to burnish that image. So initially, that narrative, that Islamist narrative that he developed, I think it worked, and the Syrian war, the conflict there, and Erdogan's support for the Muslim Brotherhood helped Erdogan burnish that image, but it also helped Erdogan to weaken his opponents. His constant reference to the CHP, he always equated the CHP, the country's main opposition secular party, with the Assad regime. And that, in many ways, delegitimized the CHP further in the eyes of the country's conservatives. So he used foreign policy in general, but Syria in particular, to strengthen his image at home and to weaken and divide his opponents. But his calculations to rely on the conservatives and the Kurds to switch to the presidential system failed, mainly due to cracks on his Islamist front, cracks with the Gulenists, problems with the Gulenists, and also, I think more importantly, Turkey's Kurds refused to back Erdogan's autocratic vision. So that's why in 2015, he didn't get what he wanted. He lost elections. He lost the parliamentary majority, mainly because of the historic victory that the pro-Kurdish party captured. And the Syrian conflict there played a role. Because before 2015, there was a ceasefire in place between the PKK and Turkey, and that was part of Erdogan's plans to secure Kurdish votes. He had launched a Kurdish opening in an effort to secure Kurdish votes. But in 2014, developments in Kobani, if you remember, ISIS was about to capture Kobani, and Erdogan said jubilantly that Kobani is about to fall. And he didn't open the borders on time to allow Kurdish fighters from different countries, including Turkey and Iraq, to go in and help the Syrian Kurdish militia there. So that really created a backlash. I remember the Kobani protests at the time. Thousands of people took to the streets in protest. They were protesting Erdogan's inaction in the face of this bloodbath. So that was a turning point in two main ways, I think. From the Kurdish point of view, and at the time I was traveling across the country, especially in the Kurdish region, talking to the Kurds, and many of them said, we are on the verge of creating our own state. So we're not going to settle for Erdogan's cosmetic changes, the cosmetic changes that he's offering to us. We want more. So their hopes were up. And from Erdogan's point of view, he had thought, before he launched the Kurdish opening, he had thought that he could secure Kurdish support for the presidential system. And he realized with Kobani protests that that was not going to happen. So that was the first indication and an important impact of what was happening in Syria on Turkish domestic politics. But the most critical point came a few months later after the pro-Kurdish party's co-chair, who is now in jail, Selahattin Demirtas, declared, we're not going to make you president. So I think that was the moment when Erdogan decided this is not going to happen. Kurds are never going to back my efforts to switch to a presidential system. And we saw that very clearly when he lost elections in 2015.
Right.
So things changed dramatically afterwards. And he allied himself with the Turkish nationalists. He resumed the fight against the PKK and the most chaotic, I think, period in the country's history unfolded in a few months between the two elections. So you could see how directly Turkish domestic politics was impacted by what was happening in Syria. And how did Erdogan use that? I think that's very critical, and we don't speak about that very often. So imagine you're in Turkey in 2015, you're a Turkish nationalist, you are so fearful that Kurds are there about to establish a Kurdish state with American weapons. So there's a lot of anxiety among Turkish nationalists. And Erdogan...
In northeastern Syria.
Northeastern Syria, that's exactly right, because in 2014, the United States airdropped weapons to the Kurdish militia fighting against ISIS in Kobani. So that was a very important moment for Turkey's nationalists. They were really afraid that finally a Kurdish state was being established with US support. And from Kurdish point of view, the Kurds themselves in Turkey, they again thought that we are achieving something big here. And Erdogan is only going to grant us some cultural rights. And we're not okay with that. So imagine two nationalisms on the rise. Kurdish nationalism and Turkish nationalism in Turkey are on the rise. And Erdogan exploited that. He rode on that nationalist surge. And thanks to that alliance with the Turkish nationalists, he managed to switch to the presidential system and managed to win election after election until 2019. So that nationalist surge, Erdogan himself boosted, did wonders for him. So that's why I think everything that happened in Syria really shaped things in Turkey and other way around. Erdogan's own decisions, the steps that he has taken in Syria, changed things dramatically for the people of Syria too. And one last thing, I think one of the most dramatic implications of the conflict in Syria for Turkey is Turkish society has changed. Turkey's social fabric has changed forever. We have 4 million Syrian refugees in Turkey. And Turkey is not known to be a tolerant country when it comes to other ethnic identities. It hasn't been able to resolve its own Kurdish problem for decades. So I can easily imagine a scenario where Turkey will be confronting a huge problem, economic, political, social problems, if it fails to integrate those 4 million Syrian refugees. So in that way, I think what happened in Syria helped Erdogan in many ways establish his autocratic regime, change Turkey forever. But then there came a time when Syria became a liability for Erdogan.
I want to turn to the election. I mean, we've talked a little bit about the presidential system. I think just as a prelude to talking about the election, it's worth pointing out that when he finally took this idea of a presidential system, which abolished the position of prime minister, for instance, among other things, to a referendum in the country, he did it because he had succeeded in referenda in the past. So in 2011, I think it was, he introduced a number of measures by referendum that allowed him to neuter the judiciary, basically to stack the courts, which had also been, along with the military, one of the pillars of the Kemalist secularist establishment before he came to power.
2010, I think.
Or 2010, Eric. Yeah. So, you know, he had a track record for success, and I'm sure he assumed that that, you know, would replicate itself in 2017. But in the event, 2017 ends up looking more like June 2015 in the sense that this was a very closely run thing. And there's pretty good reason to believe that at the end of the day, it may not have even passed, actually, that it that the vote may have been fiddled, particularly in the southeast. And that's a huge, I mean, I think it's worth for our listeners understanding that's a kind of a huge break with Turkish tradition since 1950, when two-party or multi-party elections were first held in Turkey, in the sense that elections have never been completely fair in Turkey because the government's always had outsized power. Whoever was in government, the incumbents, had outside power over the media, which were controlled by a very small number of conglomerates, all of which benefited from government contracts of one sort or another. But they've always been free. I mean, there's never been a sense that people were engaged in massive, you know, vote fraud. But in 2017, for the first time, that really, you know, was something that people became concerned about. In 2019, of course, you were saying he won elections until 2019. In 2019, the municipal elections are a huge setback for Erdogan, notably including loss of Ankara and where Mansur Yavaş was elected mayor, and Istanbul, where Ekrem İmamoğlu was elected mayor. Erdogan, of course, having been mayor of Istanbul himself, understood how important that was, basically tries to annul the election in Istanbul. But the consequence politically for him, again, backfires because İmamoğlu's reelected in the second round when they rerun it in June of 2019 by an even larger plurality or majority, actually, at that point than he had initially. So coming into the election now, he's got a lot of baggage. He's got all this Syria baggage that you've described. He's got a lot of baggage from economic mismanagement. I mean, Turkey's inflation rate, depending on how you calculate it, it's between 65 and 80%. The economy's been very badly mismanaged, in part because Erdogan, in the face of all modern economics, insists on keeping interest rates low. This is part of his populism, right? His, you know, desire to bribe voters with cheap credit and you know, a lot of government money. So the inflation rate is kind of through the roof. COVID was sort of mismanaged, you know, as well. And he's been running for a while, kind of behind, you know, most of the opposition candidates. What's in store on May 14th, you know, which is 2 weeks, I guess, from yesterday in this election? How do you think it's likely to play out, Ganu?
Yeah, before sharing my what I see as the most likely scenario in the upcoming vote, let me say something about elections in Turkey. You're right, Eric. I think Turkish democracy, I mean, even before Erdogan came to power, it's never been a perfect democracy. But one thing worked well enough in Turkey, and that was the elections. Turnout has always been high. Even in 2018, as late as 2018, the turnout was 86%. So that's a very high figure. And people always, even now, imagine we always talk about how Turkey has become an authoritarian country, and political scientists refer it as a competitive authoritarian regime, which means by definition, elections are not free and fair. But even now, go to any embassy here, Turkish embassy, you'll see how excited people are about the upcoming elections. They still have faith that change is possible through elections. So I find that remarkable. So that means elections work. But obviously, 2017 referendum was a critical turning point because it changed something in the minds of people. It was a very controversial referendum. In an unprecedented move, the Supreme Electoral Council, which is Turkey's top electoral body, allowed non-stamped ballots to be accepted as valid. And of course, many organizations, international organizations included, they decried this move to be illegal, claiming that as many as 1.1 million ballots were unstamped. So that really cast a shadow over whether elections in Erdogan's Turkey really mattered or not. So that was a turning point. And then came 2019, which changed minds again for the better, because many people thought that, okay, Erdogan lost elections, so maybe elections do matter, and maybe Turkish democracy does have a pulp. But still, I can see, having traveled to Turkey very often this year and last year, and I talked to a lot of people, there's a growing anxiety. There's hope on the one hand for a change, but people are also very anxious about several things, whether if Erdogan loses, is he just going to walk away, or is he going to engage in outright rigging? So those are all the questions that people are asking. And you're right, Erdogan is facing a lot of challenges. Even before the earthquake, he has a long list of problems, including double-digit inflation. And the most, I think, the most concerning thing in the country is food inflation, which is highest among the OECD countries. Everyone you talk to raised this point. But that's not the only problem. There's institutional breakdown. There's no rule of law. You have a growing young population who just don't see their future in the country. There's a huge brain drain. And the Syrian refugees, by the way, it's really high among voters. It's one of the top worries of voters. There are 4 million Syrian refugees, and people just don't know how this issue is going to be resolved. So a lot of problems, and there's a lot of resentment even among Erdogan's own supporters. And then came the earthquake, which obviously compounded Erdogan's problems. So now that might make you think that so domestic conditions are ripe for an opposition victory, because you put two and two together and you think about 2018, when Erdogan win elections, he captured 52% of the vote in 2018. And in 2018, we didn't have double-digit inflation. We didn't have any of the problems. I mean, we did, but in many ways, they are worse now. So you tend to think that, you know, this is a time where the opposition stands a good chance of winning. But then the next question is, wait, but this is an autocracy. then why are we getting so excited about the elections? There are so many things that he can do because he controls everything. So here is my prediction, and I can answer the question about election security, but my prediction is that I think despite all the problems, the elections are not free and fair, and Erdogan can do anything, but I still think that the most likely scenario is that the opposition is going to win, maybe not in the first round, but in the second round.
So a couple of points here. One is you mentioned his 2018 presidential election victory against Muhammad Ince, and he got 52% of the vote. Correct me, Gunul, if I'm wrong, but I think in all the elections since 2002, that is the first time that he or the AKP, which he embodies, got over 50%.
That's right. That's right.
Which tells you that Turkey is a deeply divided society. It's remained divided, and that his populism has been based on kind of polarizing the society, because he knows that the opposition is very fragmented, has a lot of fissures, and that he can mobilize his supporters more easily by these kind of polarizing tactics than the opponents can. So in this instance, the opponents got together and have united in the so-called Table of Six, which is led by the CHP, the Kemalist party, this center-left but highly nationalist. It's regarded as a social democratic party, but it's a little hard to explain to those who haven't had experience with it. It's not Tony Blair's Labour Party. Let me just put it that way. And a splinter group from the nationalists, Meral Akşener, the former Minister of the Interior from the MHP, the Nationalist Party, her E party is represented, as are parties from breakaway groups from the AKP itself. We've already talked about Ahmet Davutoğlu, but also Ali Babacan, the former deputy prime minister and treasury minister, actually one of my favorite AKP ministers when I was ambassador, as my wife sometimes described him, one of the AKP with a human face. But all of this, effort may, coalesce, but there's some deficiencies that they've got, right? Which is, even though Erdogan has been polling behind almost all of the other candidates, the one who most people think had the best chance was Ekrem İmamoğlu, the mayor of Istanbul. He was blocked, however, by Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu, the head of the CHP, a kind of colorless former bureaucrat, charismatically challenged, and who insisted, as the head of the largest party, that he be the presidential candidate. By the way, his handpicked presidential candidate, Muhammed Ince, who we just talked about a moment ago, is also still running. So he's draining 1-2% from the opposition, which is not helpful. Kılıçdaroğlu has consistently polled least well against Erdogan. There was a moment after the earthquakes, as you point out, which highlighted, sort of the what's wrong with Turkey after 20 years of AKP rule, right? Which is AFAD, the disaster relief agency, the version of FEMA, terrible job alleviating and remediating earthquake scenes, very slow to get there. Military wasn't mobilized because there's still fear about the military in the aftermath of the 2016 failed coup attempt. Turks have set aside since 1999 something like $40 billion of tax money to earthquake-proof the country because of the Istanbul earthquake in that year. And people have been asking, where did all the money go, since the 11 province disaster across the Southeast was so widespread? And the answer to that, most people know, is it went into the pockets of Erdogan's cronies in the construction industry. So given all that, in the first few weeks after the earthquake, there were a couple of polls that showed him maybe 10, 12 points behind. Most recently, the polls have closed up, and I think most observers are saying it's kind of too close to call. I know that I noticed the other day there was an Al Monitor poll that showed them literally neck and neck. I think actually Erdogan was slightly under 1 percentage point ahead in the raw tally, but it was statistically insignificant given the sample size. So am I wrong that people were more confident when it looked like it was a 10 to 12% spread because it makes it more difficult to cheat? I mean, part of the problem with the 2017 presidential referendum vote was it was so close that you could steal enough votes to win. Part of the problem they had with Imamoglu in 2019 was in the second round, he won by such a huge margin that it was too hard to cheat. So if it's really close, I mean, most people are using, like, I think a 2% standard. If the real vote is like within 2%, he can steal it. If it's more than 2%, then, you know, then it's harder for him to steal it. Is that the right metric people should be looking at when they're watching election returns come in on May 14th from Turkey?
That's right, Eric. I think, and one other thing, it's really difficult to steal in big cities. More problematic is the Kurdish region, especially. But now that we have, after the earthquake, 11 provinces have been hit by the earthquake, and there are 8 million voters there. So it gives a lot of opportunity to do things for Erdogan. But you touched upon a couple of very good points. And the first one is, Erdogan actually has always relied on alliances to maintain his majority, right? When he came to power, it was just not Islamists. You have conservatives, Democrats, social democrats. You have liberals, Turks, Kurds, large majority. Later on, it was the Islamists and Kurds. And later, from 2015, it was the nationalists. But now, as things stand today, he doesn't have that many options to turn to. He has exhausted his options. And that's one of the reasons why he's now reaching out to these fringe Islamist parties, like Hudapar, for instance, the Kurdish Islamist party. That has a violent past, but he wanted to ally with them. And then you have Erbakan Sons party now, which polls around 1%, 1.5%. And there were rumors that before, in March, he sent a delegation to speak with the PKK's imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan, something that he used before in 2019 elections too, to woo the Kurdish voters. So all those things tell me something, and that is he really needs every vote he can get. He's not in a comfortable, very comfortable position. And the second thing is that obviously autocrats, they don't need majorities to remain in power. All they need is a divided opposition. And that was the case in 2018. In 2018, we had 6 presidential candidates. We had Selahattin Demirtas, who is a very popular figure, the Kurdish leader. And then we had in 2018, Meral Akşener, E-Party, which is a splinter party that had been established in 2017. So a year after, she was fielded as the candidate. And then you had Muharrem İnce. So the opposition was very divided in 2018. But today, they are much less divided. You have 2 parties, 2 presidential candidates, Muharrem İnce and Sinan Oğan. There are different figures about their votes. They will probably, their vote is somewhere between 5 to 7%, and that will push the vote to a runoff, but not significant enough to deny the opposition a win in the second round. So I think what is different for Erdogan is he just cannot secure alliances anymore. And once he rode on the nationalist wave, he really relied on the nationalists. In 2018, the nationalist base was not fragmented enough. Today, you have a growing nationalist opposition. You have people who are fed up, like MHP supporters, far-right supporters, who are fed up with allying with Erdogan. And you have Sinan Oğan, you have E-Party. So there is a Turkish nationalism that's become increasingly uncomfortable with Erdogan, which was not the case in 2018. And also in 2018, we didn't have popular figures such as Mansur Yavaş, Ankara's mayor from the CHP, and Ekrem İmamoğlu, Istanbul mayor. So they have joined Kılıçdaroğlu's campaign. And all those things, I think, make me more optimistic about the opposition's prospects this time. And one last thing about Kılıçdaroğlu, you're right, he is always... he lagged behind others in the polls. He was the least popular candidate. Ekrem İmamoğlu and Mansur Yavaş, they were the most popular. And yet the opposition fielded him. But I see it this way. First, I think he turned out to be a better campaigner than I had expected. He's doing a good job. And the second thing is, I think he's the right man. And for some reason, he reminds me of Biden. And I see him as Turkey's Biden because... When Biden was campaigning, a lot of people were talking about how he was not charismatic enough, that he didn't have the power to beat Trump. He wasn't aggressive enough. He wasn't this, that. So people were very critical and didn't see him as the most ideal candidate. And yet, I remember talking to people here who told me, well, he's the right man. We've suffered 4 years under President Trump. Very polarized country. He divided the country. Very aggressive rhetoric. So we need a man like Biden who can unite the nation, who can reach across the aisle, who can talk to the Republicans. So I see Kılıçdaroğlu as that person for Turkey. Maybe he's not as charismatic. Yeah, he's an old man, yet still...
He's younger than Biden.
He's younger than Biden, and that's always a plus. But I think he also has all those qualities that Biden... has. He can talk to everyone, and they call him quiet force. So he's quiet. He wants to embrace everyone. He wants people to go beyond divisive issues, identity issues. So that's why I think he is the right man. He's the man that this country needs at this time. So I think that's why he turned out to be a good choice. And again, his campaign is I find it very successful. He's not only trying to unify the country, but he's offering tangible solutions to the country's problems. And as for the vote, you're right. If the opposition wins by a narrow margin, Erdogan has a track record. He might pull a Trump and not accept the results. I can see that scenario. But obviously, what will change the election result, whether the election result will be accepted, depends on where Turkey's bureaucracy stands. Turkey's top electoral body, including military, including a police force, where do they stand? Imagine a scenario, I mean, God forbid, let's say the opposition wins by a narrow margin. Erdogan says, I'm not going to accept. They stole the vote. And he calls on his supporters to take to the streets. And this time, something which didn't happen in the past, but this time it can happen. Opposition supporters will take to the streets too because they're so hopeful. And that could lead to a street violence. So in that scenario, what will the country's institutions do? Will they back an Erdogan who has lost? And I think it's not a foregone conclusion that they will support him. I've seen some signs from bureaucracy that Turkish bureaucracy is hedging its bets. Look at some of the recent decisions made by the Constitutional Court, despite Erdogan's protests, and a decision made by Turkey's top electoral body, despite protests from the AKP. So that tells me that Turkish bureaucracy is hedging its bets. And it's not going to be as easy for Erdogan to manipulate the result as he did previously.
We're running out of time, Ganul. So I have one more question before we wrap up, which is this. I mean, you've already talked a little bit about this, which is some very potentially dark scenarios about what happens if he tries to steal the election. But what strikes me about Erdogan is he's a lot like, you know, Putin or Orban or these other strongmen or wannabe strongmen, which is for him, an electoral loss is almost an existential question because he has every expectation that if he loses the election, he will be indicted and perhaps and his family will be indicted and jailed. There's a widespread perception that he has profited enormously from his 20 years in office. I mean, he's become a fabulously wealthy man, which he obviously didn't happen on his state salary. So can he actually afford to lose this election? I mean, does he have to win just for his own personal security and safety and that of his family?
Great question. I think you mentioned Putin. I think Turkey is not Russia yet. Again, as I said, elections are not symbolic. Competition is real. They might be unfree and unfair, but the competition is real. So in that regard, I think elections matter a lot more in Turkey than they do in Putin's Russia. But in terms of high stakes, yes, the stakes are very high for Erdogan. And I know a lot of people from the opposition ranks, opposition supporters, they want him to be tried for what they see as the crimes that he had committed in the 20 years he's been in power. And that raises the stakes for Erdogan even further and his family. But here is what I think. It's going to be a very messy process. Imagine if Kılıçdaroğlu wins, it's not going to be easy to open the old chapters because there are so many people in the opposition ranks right now who worked very closely with Erdogan, who served as his ministers. So I think, and I one journalist said, you know, after the elections, there will be two AKPs in the parliament, referring to Erdogan's AKP and the AKP, former AKP members of parliament who are running on CHP ticket now. So that is something to consider. And I think that tells you that it's not going to be easy for the opposition after winning the elections to try everyone, to try Erdogan. So I think that should give some comfort to Erdogan just to walk away peacefully if he wins the elections. And the second thing is, I think even if he loses the elections, Erdogan is not going to disappear. We're not going to see a Bolsonaro. He's not going to flee the country because we're talking about a man who still commands 40 to 45% of the vote. So he's going to be there waiting for the opposition to fail. Because the opposition will be inheriting a huge, big problems from economy, rebuilding the country, rebuilding the institutions, switching to the parliamentary system. So that requires a lot of political capital. And Erdogan and others in the opposition too expect the new government to fail because the problems are so huge. So that's why I think Erdogan is going to remain in the country after, even if he loses the elections. And I think that's another thing to consider when we talk about, is he gonna do something really crazy to change the election results? I think that will be a consideration for him too. So why push for a scenario that could turn violent and risk a trial maybe while you could just wait for the opposition to fail? So I think we should take these things into consideration.
Well, on that relatively speaking upbeat note, Gunul, we're going to have to wrap up. My guest has been Gunul Toll, the author of Erdogan's War, A Strongman's Struggle at Home and in Syria, published by Oxford University Press. Terrific book. If you want to understand what's going on in Turkey and you want to read something before the election to give you a good basis for decoding what's happening, I highly recommend the book. If you enjoyed this episode of Shield of the Republic, let us know. You can register that approval with a review on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and drop us a line at shieldoftherepublic@gmail.com.
The
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.